today I plan to end the discussion, well, the introduction to the discussion of the quantization of the Dirac field using a functional integral, and then I start to discuss quantization of non-abelian gauge theories, which is going to be the last part of those lectures. So first, Dirac field. And this is going to use, of course, this formalism of Bayesian calculus and integration over Grassmann variables, anti-commuting numbers, which we discussed during the last lecture. So go back to the Dirac field. So the Dirac field is just a quantization of a system of particles which are Dirac fermions. And therefore, we have seen that, in fact, this can be done. Well, the idea to do it is to start from the actions which allows to obtain the Dirac equation for the wave function, Dirac fermions, which is psi. So it's a function of two fields which are conjugate. So the action is d4x. You have psi bar of x, and you have the famous I d slash minus m, the Dirac operator times psi of x, where psi of x and psi bar of x are just, it's a field, so it's a collection of four components, where A goes from 1 to 4. I am in Minkowski 4, are the famous Dirac indices, the indices which label the four components of the Dirac spinor. So psi is a spinor field, spinor. It's a function of space-time. Psi bar is a conjugate of psi. Rx. And we'll see what is the relation between those two. And x, of course, is a point, labels a point in Minkowski space-time. So this is a time and the x vector. And it's a point in Minkowski space-time, so it's an event, okay? And of course, then d slash, the operator d slash is just the famous gamma mu d mu, where the gamma mu and the gamma nu's are Dirac matrices which satisfies the commutation relation minus 2 h mu nu. So the gamma mu are the Dirac matrices, which are 4 by 4 in 4 dimension matrices whose elements are psi mu equal the collection of psi mu a b, well, say a b mu, with a and b going from 1 to 4. Okay, satisfying those commutation relation, and I choose h mu nu to be minus 1, 1, 1, 1, 0. Okay, hence the minus sign here, which becomes a plus sign if you go to the East Coast metro. Okay, and so, so if you use this action and use the Euler-Lagrange variational principle to look for its minima, so if you take the variation with respect to psi bar of this action, you obtain the Dirac equation when you consider psi as just an ordinary field whose components are real functions. Okay. And namely, those are the wave functions of the various four components of the Dirac spinors. Okay. And so the idea in how to quantize that, so to have obtained a full fledged Dirac QFT quantum field theory with the correct Hilbert space, which is a Fock space obtained by creation and annihilation operator of fermions, is in fact to consider the psi are just generators of a very big Grassmann algebra. So let's consider psi and psi bar as generators of a big, quite big, Grassmann algebra. You see? So instead of having, as we did last time, yesterday, theta I centered upon I, with I going from 1 to n, we consider that each psi a of x and psi bar a of x are independent generators. Independent anti-commuting generators. And then it means that any functional, not necessarily local, functional, capital F, of the field psi and psi bar can be something very complicated, involving products of psi and derivative of psi at different points integrated over so. Any functional is an element of the algebra. So it's an infinite dimensional algebra. That's the idea. Okay? And then apply, and the idea is then, once we have promoted psi and psi bar as generators of this big Grassmann algebra, the action S of psi bar of psi, the Dirac action of psi bar and psi, this is a Dirac action, Dirac, is an element of the algebra. And it's a quadratic form. It is a quadratic form. Form which belongs to the algebra. Okay? And therefore, then the idea is to take this Dirac action here and define a fermionic or anti-commuting functional integral by just, let's call it Z or Dirac, by just this big functional integral of psi and psi bar of exponential of I times the Dirac action of psi bar and psi, where this is just, a bit formally, products over x, products over a of d psi bar a of x, d psi a of x, the products of integration over everything. And since we integrate over all the generator, this is a number, complex number. We project out this functional onto just its maximal degree element. And of course, since the action is a quadratic form, this is going to be just the functional determinant of the Dirac operator up to some normalization factor with a factor 1, because each psi is a complex variable. It's a wave function. So we're integrating over complex. So it's a complex. Okay. Hence the factor 1 here. And in fact, this determinant is turns out to be the Fock determinant when quantizing the by canonical formalism, the Dirac field, you end up with determinant. For instance, you know that antisymmetric wave function for products of permanence are given by completely antisymmetric forms, so they are somehow determinant. So these are determinants which appears in canonical quantization and using the rule of Fock's space for fermions appear here as determinant in the path integral formulation by this, those sets of magic rules for defining Bérézin calculus, which were devised by mathematicians and physicists. Okay, so this is just a number. But the point is that we have seen from the magic of Bérézin calculus that when you compute correlation functions of object, like, so we can compute now correlation functions of, for instance, defining psi bar A of X. So let me write it in terms of matrices. So I define psi of X by psi bar of Y. This is defined in the functional integral. So now this is a vector. This is a vector. So this is a matrix. It's a 4x4 matrix. It's a 4x4 matrix. Okay. Well, we define this formally by the same object here where we introduced psi bar and psi. So we have exactly the same rule than for the ordinary bosonic field. We have here psi of X is psi bar of Y, and we divide by Z Dirac. This is still a number. Well, the rule that we have that I've written yesterday tells us that this is just the matrix element of the inverse of this operator. And then if you count the I factor, this is just the matrix element. So this is a Feynman propagator for X and Y. So this is the matrix element of I. Well, if you work out the I factors of I d slash minus m between x and y. So this is a propagator for Dirac fermions. And if you work out what it is in momentum space, you end up with this GF of X and Y. Let's call it GF. Yes, GF of X and Y. If you write it in Fourier transform, this is integral d4p over 2 pi to the power 4 I over minus p slash minus m minus I epsilon plus. You get the correct prescription for a Feynman propagator, exponential I p x minus y. So this is a 4-vector. This is a 4-vector. And of course, p slash is just gamma mu p mu, sum of matrices. So this is a matrix. This is means M identity. So this is a 4x4 matrix, which is OK. And well, you can check that you get this I epsilon prescription either by locality, but if you are a bit careful, you may like to go to Euclidean fermions. So in this case, H is becoming just the identity operator. You work out the Euclidean action. But some high disappear, you make a Vick rotation. So the same, that's exactly the same trick and rules that we used for the bosonic, you know, the bosonic field, the scalar field. Simply, you have this recipe of doing integration of anti-commuting variables, and that's just a machinery, and you turn the crank, it provides the machinery to do the calculation, and you end up with exactly the same result. Okay? And of course, therefore, this is what you showed in QFT1 course. This is the expectation value in the vacuum of the time ordered products of the field operator psi, fermionic field operator, Dirac operator psi of x and psi bar of y. These are the fermion field operator obtained out of the A and the A dagger operators obeying anti-commuting relation for the fermions. Okay, so that's the object that you obtained in QFT1. Okay, as a course caused by Dan and Gang. Okay, and it's just, you know, in some sense, it's just that we have defined a functional integral, which seems a bit fancy because it's on anti-commuting numbers, but it provides all the perturbative rules that you have that. So you have the good propagator and you have the Vick theorem for fermions. Therefore, when you compute four-point function, n-point function, you end up with the correct results. You end up with the products of operators, of propagators, with the correct minus signs when you, depending on how you, which one you choose. So you get Vick theorem, so you can express any psi bar, etc. Green function of correlation function in terms of a sum of pairings of products of psi bar, etc., with the correct factors coming from the anti-commutation of field operators. Okay. And of course, in this notation, T of psi of x and psi bar of y is defined of psi of x, psi of y if x is here and y is here. So if x is the future of y, and it's minus what psi bar of y, psi of x, if y is in the future of x. So the operators are time ordered in time, so that the product is always a causal product, but you have a minus sign since because of anti-commuting relation. And this implies that in particular, when x and y are causally separated, this is zero. Okay, I think, yeah, because it's a time-ordered product. The ordinary product, they commute, and the time-ordered product is defined so that, I think, yeah. Okay, so everything works. We have a book, you know, a cooking book for making path integral quantization, functional integral quantization for fermions, which gives the same rules that we expect from that you got from canonical quantization. And it's going to be very useful in the following, because it works for the Dirac field, but it's going to work for any fields that obey the Fermi-Dirac statistics. Okay, so we have a cooking book, if you want. or fermion. Okay. And so I'll stop there. I will not discuss the physics of the Dirac field. You discuss it in the QED course, and we are going to go back in the next part of the lecture where we are considering gauge series. But I would like to make just a subtle tease, which is that in the canonical formulation, well, the psi bar object that I've written here is not exactly the Grassmann conjugate. So it's explained in the notes, but in fact, in the gamma function, you have a gamma term. So in the action, you see, the action is contains gamma naught. The action is I, you get psi bar, and that you get I gamma naught d naught, which is d over dt, plus I gamma, let's say, d slash, where this is the space derivative. So we can write this as a nabla. So this is time, this is space, time psi. Okay, and in fact, it's better to consider that the Grassmann conjugate, the Grassmann with two n conjugate psi star of psi is this object. So it's psi bar gamma naught. So psi bar is a covector and gamma naught is a 4x4 matrix. Okay? And therefore, in fact, when you consider the canonical formula in the canonical formalism, you have a field operator psi bar of x or of p, and its conjugate, its Hermitian conjugate should correspond to this object. So this is canonical formalism, and this is functional integrals. Okay, which is not the psi bar, which is there. And so if you do calculation, try to compare the two formalism and get some discrepancy, you should remember that in fact, this is the correspondence principle, if you want, between functional integral and canonical. The Dirac operator corresponds to psi with my choice of notation, and its conjugate is psi bar times gamma, which is something that I think you have seen in canonical quantization. There's a bit of subtlety. Okay. Okay. But there is nothing to be worried about that as long as you work with Dirac field. Okay. Okay, so I think I'll end up there. You can make exercise, and maybe I can also mention something, which is that everything here works also for non-relativistic fermions, which appears in some problems of high energy physics, for instance, in collision of nuclei in low energy nuclear physics, for instance, you have fermions, but you can neglect some relativistic effect. But of course, this is very important in condensed matter. Well, we have fermions in materials, in crystals, in conductors, in semiconductors, which are electrons and holes, and they are fermions, so they have spin. And they obey the Fermi-Dirac statistics, but they are non-relativistic. They move at non-relativistic speeds. And for instance, in the theory of supraconductivity, ICS theory, in the Landau theory of conductivity, where you have a Dirac C, you have electrons, you have holes. So you have fields which are the wave function of the electrons and the holes, and you may be interested in quantizing this quantum system of non-relativistic fermions using path integral and functional integral formalism, for instance, the Landau theory, also in Bose-Einstein enunciation theory. Of course, Bose-Einstein refers to bosons, but bosons can be bound state of fermions. Okay, and then, well, this formalism works. Simply, you have to replace a relativistic action by a non-relativistic action, like the famous Landau-Ginzburg actions for fermions. Okay, so this formalism is very general, so you should keep in mind. Okay. Okay, so I'll stop there for Dirac field, and we are going to use it in probably two lectures from now, possibly three, when we are going to discuss the gauge fixing procedure in non-abelian gauge theory, and we are going to see those famous Fadeyev-Popov's ghost field, which are fermions, but non-spinors, not spinors, but fermions. So also for Fadeyev-Popov ghost fields in gauge series. So this formalism will be very useful. And of course, it's also useful in supersymmetric theory, where you have fermions and bosons. And you can formulate supersymmetry as a symmetry operation in a superspace which contains both Grassmann generators and ordinary complex fields, ordinary numbers, which mix everything. Okay. So now, non-abelian gauge theories. So, non-abelian gauge theories, I think I have no needs, and you know probably some of you better than me why these are interesting. Non-abelian gauge theories are, of course, now the basis and the basic building blocks of the theory of fundamental interaction, but from gravity, which is also some kind of theory with a non-abelian, low gauge symmetry, which is a symmetry under diffeomorphism, but that's a bit different. But of course, now we know that all fundamental interaction, electroweak and strong interaction, and possibly Hausdorff's interaction, which theoreticians, expect or at least think they exist at higher energy, are expected to be, in fact, gauge theories, but associated with non-abelian symmetry group. And well, this goes back to the 50s and the 60s, but of course, the standard model was built in the 60s and the 70s, and quantum electrodynamics was built in the 70s. And so that people have extended that study, are still studying that. And so, well, so there are generalizations from Maxwell theory. Maxwell-Dirac theory, which is quantum electrodynamics, which is based on the U1 symmetry group, which is the gauge group of Maxwell equation, which is abelian. It's the simplest of the continuous commutative groups, to higher dimensional symmetry groups. For instance, the group SU2, which is important in the electroweak interactions because it's based on products of SU2 and U1. The group SU3, which is important for QED, so this electroweak. QCD, of course, quantum chromodynamics. And then in grand unified theory, people have versions of grand unified theory still to be checked experimentally, but based on larger groups like SO5 and some others. Okay. So I'm going to use what you did in the front end lectures about Lie groups, Lie algebra, a theory of representation. Well, I hope you still remember what I did. I have some notation reminder in my lecture notes, and I hope they are not incompatible with the lecture notes. Don't know who did that. This was Sibra. Yes. Okay. Anyway, so but I mostly will work with the SU2 group. First, it's important for the electroweak interaction, but also it's the simplest group. Okay, so mostly SU2. And of course U1, when I'm going to discuss the difference between the two. Okay. So let's start with global symmetries. So let's start with global symmetries, because we are going to discuss currents. And in fact, gauge theories have to be introduced when you have a theory where you don't have local interaction between the fields, but current, large distance interaction between the charges mediated by some gauge particles like the photon. QED is, in quantum electrodynamics, the electromagnetic forces are long distance. Coulomb law, Lorentz law, interaction between currents, Faraday laws, are long distance interaction because they are mediated by massless particles, the photon, the electromagnetic waves. Okay. So I'm going to consider just, I start with just a scalar field. So I start with the SU2 group, SU2 symmetry. In fact, the U1, which is U1, is SU2 cross U1. But so, and I start with a scalar field. So I start, let me.
U1.
Pardon?
SU2 cross.
What?
Well, why U1 equals to
SU2
cross U1?
U2, I'm sorry. That's a typo. Yes, of course. Thank you. Yeah, it's U2. Oh. Okay, so I start first from a scalar field. So spin zero. And that's going to be important if we have time to discuss the X mechanism. It's very important, which lives in the fundamental representation. So I have a field phi. I call it phi, I denote it phi, And it, in fact, it has two components. So in fact, there are two kinds of particles, phi 1 and phi 2. So there are two fields, two different kinds of particles. And so they have two components, which and the components, the indices A and B, so those indices are indices of the group. Okay. So group representation. So in fact, I should have taken slightly different notation for the Dirac indices. Okay. So and the interaction between those fields and the particles which are represented by the field satisfy a symmetry which is the SU2 symmetry. So we have a SU2 symmetry. SU2 symmetry, and this field is in the fundamental representation. Phi is in the fundamental representation of SU2, which means that an element of the group SU2 is a 2x2 matrix. And it's a 2x2 unitary matrices. So it's a matrix that satisfies the fact that G is G11, G12, G21, G22. And it satisfies the fact that G times G inverse, well, no, G dagger is 1. And in addition, it satisfies the fact that its determinant is 1. That's SU2. Determinant is 1. Otherwise, you deal with U2. Okay? And and therefore, the symmetry group acts. If you have G, it means that phi goes into phi of G, you let G act, which is just G times phi. So you have a 2x2 matrix times a 2 vector. Okay. And the fact that it acts like, you know, like the matrix acts on the vector means that this is in the fundamental representation. That's the definition of the fundamental representation. Okay? And now, of course, we need, since we are dealing with complex vectors, so phi 1 and phi 2 are complex fields. We are going to deal with its conjugate field, phi, complex conjugate, which is just a covector, phi 2, where you take the complex conjugate. Conjugate. Okay. The fact that you have complex fields means that each phi represents complex particles. I'm sorry, charged particles. So if phi was real, it would be neutral particles, but they are charged particles. Okay. And then of course, if you want to write an SU2 or an U2 invariant action, yes?
What does it mean to have a two-component scalar field? Shouldn't a scalar just be a number?
It's a scalar with respect to the spin. So it has no spin structure. But of course, it's a vector. So this field is a vector for the SU2 transformation, because it belongs to the fundamental representation. So I agree that the denomination is a bit misleading. If you prefer, as both prefer, bosonic field. Okay. Okay, so of course, what is the possible actions for this? An action for this field, S, for this field, which is a vector in the fundamental orientation. Well, by generalization with what we did for the bosonic, you know, scalar field, field with no spin, no charge, it's just that you integrate in four dimensions, for instance. So you have d mu phi times d mu phi and phi bar. Then this is a vector, a covector, so this is the number, plus mass terms, and you can get phi bar phi phi, plus, if you want, an interaction term that I'm going to write 8. I normalize by 8 for some reason, which is this square. Okay, and of course, phi bar times phi is just phi bar 1 times phi 1 plus phi bar 2 times phi 2. Okay. And of course, with this definition, phi bar transforms I phi bar of G with the G dagger phi bar, I'm sorry, phi bar times G dagger, because it's a conjugate, but it's a covector. Hence, since G times G dagger equals G dagger times G equals 1, this is an invariant. Okay. So those are global symmetry transformation because you apply the same G. Global SU2 or U2 transformation. Okay. Because you apply the same G, but phi is depends on X. So you should write this as this. Okay. Therefore, this is a theory which has a global symmetry. The action is invariant because you can check that this is invariant because G doesn't depend on X. This is invariant, this is invariant. And therefore, the theory has Noether's currents. So the Noether currents are associated to the the Noether currents are associated to infinitesimal symmetry transformation. Okay. So we have currents, but they are labeled by the various infinitesimal transformation you can obtain by applying unitary transformation. Okay, and unitary matrices with determinant 1 can be written as combination and exponential of 3 different transformations. So in fact, they are labeled by some index A. This index is not going to be the index of the Dirac index. So A, there will be 3 index because there are 3 generators. For SU2, which are just related to the Pauli matrices. So we have 3 generators. Let me call them TA. A equals 1, 2, 3. Where the TA has just 1/2 of sigma A, where the sigma A are the usual Pauli matrices. You see? So the TAs are antisymmetric, traceless, 2 by 2 matrices. Okay. And the TA form, so the set of TAs form a basis of generators for all anti-symmetries traceless 2x2 matrices, namely what's called the Lie algebra, little SU2 of 2 of the group SU2. So that's the standard definition for the Lie algebra. It's the small letters and capital letters here. Okay. And the Lie algebra is just, you know, the algebra of infinitesimal deformation. This means that you can write, if G is, you can write always G as exponential I sum. Let's call it alpha, which when alpha is small is 1 plus I alpha, with alpha some antisymmetric. So alpha belongs to this Lie algebra, and therefore alpha can be written as alpha A T A, where this is a real number and this is a 2x2 matrix. And this is a general form of antisymmetric traceless 2x2 matrices. Okay.
So if we have this I in the expansion, then I think should be Hermitian instead of antisymmetric.
You're right. Hermitian. I'm sorry, I took the wrong base. The mathematician considers antisymmetric with no factor. Yeah, okay. So, of course, this, yeah, I should have written the. You're right. I'm very sorry about that. This is stupid. So, the sigma A, I never remember which the sigma A are. They are written somewhere. Okay. And so, in fact, you have three possible independent infinitesimal transformation, and to each transformation is associated a current. And you apply Noether's theorem, and you find that those currents are just G mu A equal I over 2, phi bar T A D mu phi minus D mu phi bar T A phi. So this is a vector, this is a 2x2 matrix, this is a covector. So each of this is of course something which depends on x. So this each component of this vector is a number, it's a function. Okay? And you can check that d mu g mu equals zero. So that conserved current if you apply the equation of motion. And so that are conserved current. And since you have A currents, so the G mu are numbers, real, are real functions. And you can regroup them into an element of the algebra. So you can rewrite this G as a something which is G mu, which is G mu A T A. So that's a 2x2. Matrix, Hermitian traceless, whose elements are function of x. So it's a field with value in the Lie algebra of the group. And that's a compact way to write the set of the three currents. This is a field that goes from Minkowski space or real space or MD to the Lie algebra SU2 of the group. Okay. Okay, so well, let's do the break now. And we'll introduce the electromagnetic field later. Yes? Yes?
So why did we pick SU2 and not U2?
Because pardon?
The action is invariant under U2 actions, right?
Yeah, in fact, the action is invariant under U2. So you have another current, which I have not written here. But
why did we choose the dead instead?
Just because that's the simplest group. It's a simple group. So there is only the, when coupled to electromagnetic field, there will be only one electro simple electromagnetic field strength, and no, so it's the simplest case. But for instance, for the electro weak theory, the standard model, there is both an SU2 and a U1. So there is a symmetry which corresponds to the gauge bosons of the weak interactions, the Zs and the Ws, and there is another gauge field, which is the standard electromagnetic field. Okay. Of course, since SU2 is, locally the same than the group O3 of rotation, you can do the same thing with a field which is a vector with three components, but of real functions, real fields, and then apply the same formalism. Yes?
Should there be an A subscript over the conserved current? Because didn't we say that we have three conserved?
Yeah, there is an A, yes, of course. There is a conserved current for each A. But in addition, this object is globally conserved as a function. You can write also that d mu, g mu is equal to zero when you consider this matrix valued current, which encompasses the three currents. Okay. Well, let's start at 5 to 11 to 10. Okay. I think it's correct. I'm not 100% sure. Yes, but that's what I did here.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, it depends on how you define your causal order. So it's a matter of convention.
Yeah.
For physicists, that's the usual convention. For mathematicians, it's often the opposite. But mathematicians working on operator algebra theory, in fact, have the opposite notation when they apply operator. Combine operators. They go on the usual Western writing. Yeah, so they don't refer, they don't go back as soon as they write an equation.
So for general relativity, it can also be understood as a gauge theory, right?
It can be formulated as a gauge series because you can view the field bind as gauge field and the diffeomism. But the way the symmetry are implemented is a bit different. But of course, for many aspects, for instance, you have the curvature tensor, which is the analog of the field strength.
Right, yeah.
And so there are analogies, and that's what has been, which are useful, but that's not the end of the story. Because basically the field are not, spin one, but spin two, the graviton is a spin too. So the symmetry are realized in a different ways. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
But for instance, some approach of quantum gravity, like group quantum gravity, relies on trying to push this analogy as far as possible.
Right.
But then you run into difficulties because you at some point you see the difference. The gauge constraint, for instance, as far as I know, I'm not an expert at all in quantum gravity, but you have some experts here, some of the inventors, have to be implemented in a different way than in gauge theory. That's much more complicated.
What's your
except in the three dimension, where somehow it's simpler.
Yeah,
this is the like 2 plus 1 quantum gravity.
Right? Huh?
2 plus 1.
Quantum. I mean, 2 plus 1 gravity, it's, well, it's not that trivial because
yeah,
still
yeah.
people are still working on it, but it's simpler.
It seems like I've read a lot recently about, and I don't know if this is more so condensed matter people or probably not, but just in general, this idea of gauge theories, gauge symmetries are not symmetries, redundancies.
Yes.
But we still call them symmetries.
Yeah, the language is a bit ambiguous, but that's the one that we use, and that's you still have currents, for instance, in well, some are not observable, but you know, gauge, you know, QED is a gauge theory, but still there are currents in QED because we measure them. When you have electron flowing in a wire, you see a current. So there are still currents, but it's a small part of the whole. You know, the whole group of gauge symmetry is mostly a redundancy symmetries. But this redundancy is useful, is essential in order to have a theory which is unitary. It's convenient to write everything in terms of gauge potentials, because then locality is clear from the beginning. But then you have to ensure that things are unitary, and it's this huge gauge symmetry which becomes which is useful. And we'll see later if you you know, when you gauge fix and introduce the ghost, there is a global symmetry that remains, which is called the BRST symmetry, which is a global symmetry. So it has currents. It's in some sense a physical theory.
Yeah. I've read it. I think we'll really understand.
Yeah, it's a beautiful mathematical tool. Yeah.
The cohomology of the...
There is cohomology theory, everything, and the physical state, in fact, has the state with no charge, no BRST charge. So you cannot observe those currents because you only deal with, you know, neutral states. You cannot manipulate with the somehow fields of those BRST, of your BRST theory. But still, this is there.
This is the kind of jumping off point for this topological theory stuff? Or
it's related, but I'm not very inspired. Okay, let's not speak about it. Okay, so let's start again. Yes?
Good question. So this 2x2 matrix you're saying, are you saying that's the K mu?
Yeah, you can write a field which is a 2x2 matrix out of the real field G mu A.
Okay.
And it's written in the notes, but you can take you just take the value of the sigma matrices, which is written somewhere here, and what you get is that where is it? Yeah, you get that this this G mu field is just, it's a bit complicated. Yeah, no, but, let me just write it like this way. That G mu is just 1/2 of G mu 1 minus G mu, yes. I have to check a bit. Okay, I'll write that later for the similar things. Okay. So, before going to the gauge field, let me see that you can write exactly the same thing for Dirac field. So, a Dirac field in the fundamental representation. So, now you consider a Dirac field psi, which is a combination of psi, which is psi 1 and psi 2. So you have two Dirac fermions, So, and each Dirac fermion is, of course, a four component Dirac field. Okay. And you can write the same thing, and you can write a current for the Dirac field. You can write psi bar as psi bar 1 and psi bar 2. Okay, and you can write the ordinary currents, which are just the Dirac current. So you have three currents, which are G mu A is psi bar times gamma mu T A psi. So here, T A is a 2x2 matrix. Gamma mu is a 4x4 matrix. The psi contains indices. So the psi is a set where you have psi I and alpha, where alpha goes from 1 to 4 are Dirac, and I goes from 1 to 2 are indices for the fundamental representation. And you end up with something which is a number, because you contract all the indices. And you have, again, three currents that you can gather into a 2x2 matrix, traceless G mu matrix. OK. Pardon?
Are we using notation here? You have a gamma upper mu T lower K on the left hand side, you have lower mu.
Yeah, that's because I took. Let's what? Yeah, okay. Let's put. Let's put up and down indices in the usual way. These are Lorentz indices, so they go up and down with the H mu nu. And these are indices in the adjoint representation, so they go up with the standard metric, which is 1, 1, 1. The same for the eyes. Okay. So of course, now, if we follow what has been done for QED.
So I have one additional question for the
yes?
current. So now phi here has eight components.
Yeah, psi has eight components.
So, but gamma mu has four by four matrix.
Yeah, but this is a 4x4 matrix. So in some sense, this is gamma mu, in fact, here, is gamma is a 1 times gamma mu, where this is 4x4, and this is 1, 2x2. And what I call TA is TA times 1, where this is 4x4, and 2x2. So this is, in fact, gamma, what I'm writing gamma mu TA, I should write it as TA tensor products with gamma mu. I was rigorous. Yes?
Before, when we had the G mu that only was a number, not a matrix.
Yes.
The conservational current, like,
yes.
Had a physical meaning.
Yes.
Say the same thing here. Like,
so it's just, when I say that this is G mu, it means that this is true for all the components of the matrix. It's just that. G mu is a linear operator. It acts on each component by taking the derivative with respect to x of the each component of the matrix.
So each component has a physical meaning?
Each component? Well, each component are related to the three currents. So it's just a convenient way to regroup and manipulate and make calculation without taking care of which basis we have found. Because we could have taken a different basis for the algebra. Yes?
Why are we like redefining gamma mu like that? Like, why are we having the tensor product?
It's just a definition of this. If I have two matrix labeled by T A I G and gamma mu alpha beta, this is a matrix element of T A gamma mu I alpha G beta. It's just this. So the tensor products of two matrices is just the matrices with, you know, couples of indices defined by just multiplying the elements, the corresponding elements. That's the definition of a tensor product.
Okay.
the tensor product. It's just, if you are not very familiar to that, I can explain to you, and that, but that's an somehow elementary, well, not so elementary, but simple concept of algebra. Okay. Okay, so now vector field. So, if you want to have a theory where those fields interact through those currents, we know from the example of the electromagnetism and QED that the only way is to introduce additional vector fields. And the vector fields in electromagnetism are space vector. So we introduce vector fields, namely fields that, so let me call this A, which is a mu of x. Vector field A labels a collection of a mu of x in electromagnetism. This is a gauge potential. That's the simplest way to, because out of the gauge potential, of course, you introduce the electric and magnetic field, but formulating an action and quantizing them in terms of A and B is more complicated, especially in the case of non-abelian symmetry. So we need gauge field coupled to the matter. And now, for U1, there is only one current, because there is only one generator of U1. Here we have three generators. So we expect to have three gauge field coupled to the three currents. So here we need three gauge fields. Three kind of photons. Okay? So A goes from, so mu, now this is mu is goes one to four, which is a Lorentz index. Index, and A goes from one to three is a SU2 index. Okay. Which labels the component, the generator of the Lie algebra. Okay. So, in fact, this gauge field is expected to live in the Lie algebra. So, if you define, you can define A of X as A mu of X as A mu A T of X times T A. And you have a vector field with value in the Lie algebra. So that's a convenient notation to group this. So A of mu of x belongs to the Lie algebra, little SU2, which is the Lie algebra. SU2. So it's a 2 by 2 matrix, which is traceless. Okay? But it's a vector. It's a vector. It's a space time vector as for ordinary Maxwell theory. It transforms like a vector under Lorentz rotation. Okay, vector. So it transforms under Lorentz transformation. A transforms at lambda A, where lambda is a matrix for Lorentz transformation. Okay. And it corresponds to a spin one field. Transform like a vector, not like a spinor, and not trivially like a spin zero field. So it's a spin one field. Okay, so the only difference is that this object is belongs to the Lie algebra. And here I can write it in terms of component. A mu is going to be by 1/2 A mu 3 minus A mu 3, A mu 1 minus I A mu 2, and A mu 1 plus I A mu 2. Because I'm using, now I found that sigma 1 is 1, I'm sorry, sigma 1 is 0, 1, 1, 0, sigma 2 is 0 minus ii 0, and sigma 3 is 1 0 0 minus 1. So you see those are Hermitian traceless matrices. And the 1 half comes from the fact that the TAs are 1 half of the sigma A. Okay. So it's a multiplet. So this object here is a multiplet in the Lie algebra. Okay. It's a multiplet in the Lie algebra. While the A mu are real fields. Yes.
Can you explain what you mean by a multiplet?
Well, that's physics, you know, the physicist language, mathematician two of something which belongs to a representation. So this object is a multiplet of fields. That's okay. Forget about it if you don't like it. But you will meet this denomination in high energy physics. Okay. Okay. In fact, I think it's the opposite. In fact, it's A times lambda minus 1, simply because the indices are downstairs where it's x goes to lambda x. Because the x is indices upstairs and A's are indices downstairs. Okay. Anyway, that's the same transformation law that for the electromagnetism and Maxwell theory. Okay. Okay, so now you know that for electromagnetism, promoting the U1 symmetry to a local gauge symmetry, namely, considering transformation now where the gauge transformation depends on x, can be realized if you introduce covariant derivatives. So if you replace in the actions and in the currents, if you go, so once we have that, to build a gauge theory. So we want a theory where instead of transforming, for instance, the field phi, a gauge transformation will be transforming phi into phi g of x equal g of x phi of x. Remember, this is a vector. This is a matrix. It's a local gauge transformation. So G of X is now a field. So G of X depends on X. So it's a mapping from Minkowski space into the gauge group, SU2. But it depends on X. Depends on X in an arbitrary way, but of course independent of phi. But depends on X, but of course independent of phi. So you consider a gauge transformation, a function g of x, and then you see how all the fields transform under this transformation. And you want an action which is still invariant under those gauge transformations. So in order to do this, to have an action which is now invariant under those transformations, you need to introduce a gauge field. You need to introduce a covariant derivative, which basically contains the coupling between the matter and the gauge field, okay? And and that's it. Okay, so you need to introduce covariant derivatives. And I'm going to explain how one does that. So covariant derivatives. For a field, so the field phi, for instance, belongs to the fundamental representation. The Dirac field that I've just briefly introduced here, they also belong to the fundamental representation. So they are vectors, two component vectors, okay? So the fundamental, the covariant derivative is defined the following way. So we go from d mu to d mu, covariant derivative, which depends on A mu, which I remember, A mu is a 2x2 matrix. And the definition is just a generalization of what is done for electromagnetism. So if you take a vector field, so if you consider, for instance, what is d mu of phi, where phi belongs to the fundamental representation, then this is the ordinary derivative, d mu of phi. And then we have a term which involves both phi and the field A, the gauge field A. Mu, because it has to be a Lorentz invariant. Okay, so it has to transform like d mu, but d mu and a mu transforms like this. Okay, and but then now, well, for electromagnetism, this is just minus I. Well, you may have the E, the charge of the electron, but that's just the redefinition of the field. So I set the charge of the electron to be one. Now, so in electromagnetism, that's okay because this is a real number. Well, this is a complex number. This is a real number. But now this is a vector. This is a matrix. And you have, so A is a matrix. So you can write this like that. So this is a vector. And this is a matrix. So you can get a vector. But better to write it in terms of, so this is a vector, matrix vector. But better to write it in terms of component. This is d mu of phi minus a mu a of x. Remember, this depends on x, this depends on x, this depends on x, this depends on x. Minus I A mu A T A of X phi of X. Because this is a real number, this is a 2x2 matrix, this is a matrix. See? Or if you prefer even better, you can write it in terms of the I indices of the vector. You can write that D mu phi of X I, this is d mu phi I of x minus I a mu a of x t a I g phi g of x. Then the t a I g is the I g component of the A generator. So, which are matrices, so if you prefer. So this is the definition. I'm a bit confusing here, but this is the definition of the covariant derivative for fields in the fundamental representation. Okay? And then, as for electromagnetism, we know how a field transforms here under a local gauge transformation. But I've defined what is a local gauge transformation. So it's a local gauge transformation. It's a transformation when you G depends on X, but if it's an infinitesimal, that's parallel what we do with electromagnetism.
Sorry,
in the indices of the
what?
Generator in the last
yes.
version, I and j are for the
yeah I and j goes from 1 to 2. So for instance, you consider t 1. Well, let me write it here because I have here. You see, if you have t 1, this is 1/2 of sigma 1. So t 1 1 1 is 0. T 1 1 2. This is a line and a column is 1. Ti 2 2 0. T 1 2 1 is 1, etc. So IG are the line and column indices of this matrix, and A is the index of the Pauli matrix. Okay. Of course, with 1/2. Because I have this 1/2. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So let's go back to what I wanted to say here. You want to see what is the effect of performing a local gauge transformation infinitesimal. So infinitesimal means that you consider that g of x is just 1, the matrix 1, plus I alpha of x plus some higher order terms. You consider that alpha is infinitesimal here. Okay. But remember now, alpha is a 2 by 2, is an element of the algebra, belongs to the algebra, little su2. So this is a 2 by 2 raise less Hermitian matrix. In particular, alpha of x can be written as alpha A of x TA, where all the alpha A of x are real functions of x. So we have 3 real local generators of gauge transformation. Of local gauge transformation. Okay. Well, we know how the field phi transforms. You just apply that. You see that under a local gauge transformation, phi transforms into phi plus I alpha of x, or phi of x, if you prefer, transform like phi of x plus I alpha of x times phi of x. So this is a 2 vector. This is a 2 by 2 matrix. So we get a phi vector. Okay, and or if you prefer, in terms of component, you can write it easily. This is a 2 vector. This is a 2 by 2 matrix. But depending on x. Okay. So that's because phi is in the fundamental representation. Okay. Now we need to know how does A mu transform under a local gauge transformation. So you need to generalize the gauge transformation law for the electromagnetic potential. But, and the, well, we need, the game of the rule is that we need to perform a transformation on AMU such that d mu, the operator d mu, is invariant. under local gauge transformation, because this is going to ensure that the COE is gauge invariant. Okay, and well, the recipe for electromagnetism is that A mu transforms like A mu plus I d mu of minus one. In fact, you can rewrite the transformation law for the electromagnetic field like this, with g equal 1 plus I alpha, where g and g bar are just U1 transformations, so they are just phases. So it works for electromagnetism, but it turns out that it works also for this case. It's going to work for any group. So this is the transformation law. And if you work out the transformation law for alpha, alpha being a 2x2 matrix, you end up with the fact that where is it written in terms of alpha? You end up with this is A mu plus d mu of alpha, where here you have a covariant derivative. But alpha doesn't belong to the fundamental representation. Alpha belongs to the adjoint representation. So you need to generalize the definition of covariant derivative to on fields in the adjoint like alpha. Alpha, which is a 2x2 matrix. Okay, well, this was a definition for phi. So here you had a vector, and here you had just a matrix. A mu is still a matrix here, but you need to have an object which acts on a matrix and transform it of a matrix. And the definition turns out to be covariant derivative of a matrix is the ordinary derivative of the matrix. And you replace the minus I times A times the vector by minus I times the matrix alpha of x. It has to be multiplied. It has to multiply, A mu. It has, you have A mu of x, which is a matrix. It has to multiply alpha of x. But in order to be consistent with the SU2 trick, you have to take the product in the Lie algebra, not the ordinary product. The product in the Lie algebra, which is just the Lie products, which is a commutator. So this is a Lie product, which equals a commutator for SU2. For some more completed group, it's not the simple commutator. So you see, covariant derivative acting on in the fundamental representation, you just multiply phi by A, And for things acting in the fundamental, in the adjoint representation, these are commutators of the generators by the gauge field. But this is quite natural because in some way this is a definition of the fundamental representation. This is just nothing to be surprised. This is a definition of the fundamental representation. You are a bit. So this is a mu. Plus, well, there is a I here. No, this is d mu. So this is, this is a mu plus d mu alpha minus I commutator of a mu with alpha. Okay. So this is a definition. This is a transformation law for the gauge field. Okay. And you see that, which comes from the correct definition of a covariant derivative for fields living in the adjoint representation. Like, yeah?
On the bottom right board, you mean the definition of the adjoint representation instead of the fundamental?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. It's a typo. It's time for me to stop. Adjoint. Of course. Representation. Okay. And you see that this is the ordinary term in the gauge transformation over the gauge field for QED. This term is new. This term is new. It's not present in Maxwell theory. And it's not present in Maxwell theory because here, this is a complex number. Well, this is a real number. This is a real number. The commutator is just a difference of the products in the two orders, so it's zero. It's new. It's non-zero, different from zero, because SU2 is not commutative. It's not a commutative group. It's a non-abelian group, therefore its Lie algebra is non-trivial. Okay, and of course, it is zero for SU2. It's zero for U1, because U1 is abelian. And all the, you know, the difference and the interesting feature of the non-abelian gauge theories come from the fact that commutator enters in the game. Okay, so we have, we know how a field in the fundamental representation transform under a local gauge transformation. This is basically the same thing than for electromagnetism, except that you have phases times a complex number, and this is replaced by a vector and a matrix. That's what to be expected. And this is how the gauge field transforms, and it transforms with this new term, which comes from the non-abelian structure of the gauge group. Okay, so it's time to stop here. Next time, so tomorrow, I'm going to write the action. Therefore, we'll see which interaction and which new interaction between the field, the particle of the theory, and the gauge field, the photons of the theory, arise from the fact that the theory is not gauge invariant. Okay. So, thank you and see you tomorrow.